This is a People First Radio podcast.
A researcher studying gambling addiction is concerned about Ontario's approach to regulating the gaming industry. In 2021, Canada legalized single-game sports betting. The following year, Ontario became the first province in the country to regulate gambling sites beyond its own provincial crown corporation. Ontario's iGaming website says there are 50 contracted operators running 84 gaming websites in the province. In comparison, according to the government of BC's website, PlayNow.com is the only legal regulated gambling website in BC. Iris Belotis is associate director of the Peter Boris Center for Addictions Research. She says she's had an interest in research on gambling addiction for around 25 years. The McMaster associate professor was one of a group of four profs who raised concerns in The Conversation about the public health impacts of Ontario's changes around gambling regulation. I asked her, how have things changed since those rules came into effect?
I don't think we actually have a very good idea. We know that gambling and problem gambling is a public health issue. Ontario launched this massive IGO, Internet Gaming Ontario, and there is no arm's length supervision research into what is going on in Ontario. Myself and some colleagues wrote this piece about the deep need that we have to understand what is happening in our province in terms of gambling rates, problem gambling rates, changes in play. I don't think there's anyone in Ontario that is unaffected by it, from hearing and seeing ads to all the opportunities for play. But we have very, very little idea of how things have been impacted by this massive change in industry.
You talked maybe about a lack of understanding or maybe even a lack of data about how things have changed on a public health level since this change in Ontario in 2022. What kind of things do we know about the impacts of gambling on public health more generally?
So we do know very little. Just before IGO launched in Ontario in April 2022, my colleagues and I launched a survey just to get a rough sense. And in that survey, we found 9% of people, of respondents in our survey, already met criteria for problem gambling, which is much higher than the 2 to 5% that's normally cited for problem gambling. So already in 2022, the rates were seemingly quite high. Now, recently, there's some statistics coming out that potentially the rate could be already closer to 11%, but again, without systematically and carefully studying changes, we don't know. And I think part of the piece that we wrote highlights the fact that the government of Ontario is hugely benefiting from the funds that are returned back to the government. They're generating an enormous amount of tax revenue and profiting heavily for it. So we emphasize the need for independent research, for independent oversight. If the government of Ontario is receiving large amounts of funds back, they cannot be the one overseeing this industry. It is not in their best interest to find any problems with gambling and problem gambling rates in Ontario, being that they're profiting quite heavily from it.
What are the things that someone experiencing problem gambling can go through that we might not think about if we don't have some kind of connection to that experience in our life?
I think to a certain extent, problems with gambling fall on a continuum. So you can think about that at first, perhaps someone might not be that honest about how much time they spend gambling. So to their partner, they may say, oh, I was just talking with a friend or doing something online. But actually, you know, they may have not just been They may have been gambling for half an hour, for all night, staying up. Sometimes it's the amount of time that's spent that can be one of the first indicators. There's a difficulty in cutting back. You say you're just going to, play for an hour or so, you end up playing for 4 hours, and suddenly the afternoon is gone, or it's the middle of the night. So there's signs like that are quite similar, actually, to criteria for substance use disorders as well. So inability or difficulty cutting back. There are some signs of withdrawal, or there's sort of preoccupation as well. So you're always thinking about, you might be out with friends, but you're actually thinking about gambling and maybe how you might place bets differently next time, or strategizing. So there's slowly there's more and more preoccupation with gambling, and it can continue to the point that, for example, some people might commit crimes as well, with embezzlement or even stealing from loved ones. And we don't have a very good idea of how much that occurs, because it's difficult to it's very stigmatized, and often loved ones won't report that that their husband or spouse used all of their savings for gambling.
Sometimes, if, say, prohibition were to come up as a historical topic, people would talk about the idea that when alcohol sales became no longer legal, that people were still going to do this thing anyway, and money went to the black market. What do you think is the appropriate framework to have something like gambling either legalized, regulated in some different way, or not legalized?
Yeah, I think prohibition is very extreme, and we have other substances that, like alcohol, like tobacco, like cannabis now in Canada, that are legal. And I think it's about recognizing that lots of people use substances, lots of people gamble. In Canada, the rates vary slightly between provinces, but around 70 to 80% of Canadians gamble in some form. People often think of going to casinos, but it could be as simple as buying a scratch-off ticket when you go get gas. So we all, or many people, engage in different forms of gambling. So I think many people enjoy it and do so responsibly and have fun. It's often part of a night out, for example. People go to casinos and there's nice restaurants. There's a sort of a culture built around it. But there are some people that experience problems with gambling, and so we need to have proper measures in place to understand what's happening and prevent, or in the more extreme forms, provide good treatment to people that have gambling problems. And I think one of the things that I try to emphasize as a researcher, and particularly as a gambling researcher who does work on the neurobiology of gambling, is sometimes there's a wrong tendency to focus just on the individual. It's the individual, it's their brain, they're doing this. And that's actually the wrong way to look at this. Gambling occurs in a context, it occurs in an environment. You're not just in a bubble by yourself. We know that games are very active in how they tap into psychological features that we all have. And so you're not, it's not just one individual in a, like I said, in a bubble. It's rather this interplay between the individual and all of these gambling features that we're just starting as researchers to get an idea of. Things like losses disguised as wins, things like near misses when the reels line up and that just the last reel doesn't align, and you feel this frustration like a win is near and you just missed it. Like, there are so many features that, as researchers, we're just scratching the surface of, that keep you hooked, that keep you wanting to play more, that you feel frustrated at a specific type. Losses aren't equal, it turns out. They have different effects on us. They keep you playing because you feel often that a win is near. There's the environment, the VIP culture around being someone special and admired and looked at, and you have special skills. These are really promoted by the industry. So to focus just on the individual and say, say this is you, this is your fault, is absolutely the wrong approach. And that's why we need a much broader research strategy to understand everything that that gambling is and how it affects us, because nobody is immune to these effects. We all respond when we hear bells and whistles and think you've won. All it taps into, as I said, psychological features that we all have about reward and penalties.
When you look at that from a public health perspective, and say a study suggests that maybe 9% of people are impacted by this, how would that tendency to look at this as an individual problem, like how does that change for you?
I think it changes in that the focus has to be more on the environment, on what sort of environments lead people to play differently than they maybe normally would, to make certain types of decisions that they normally wouldn't. So we need to understand a lot more about the interplay between the two, rather than just focusing on one thing. So the individual, the context, gaming features, and then the wider environment.
On the individual level, are there any specific barriers people who are going through problem gambling face to getting out of that situation?
Yes, there are many. There's, for example, if you try and avoid gambling triggers, which could be almost anything, it's very, very difficult, especially when you think about the amount of ads out there. It's difficult to avoid seeing, hearing ads. It's difficult if you have a gambling problem. Also, people are often contacted by casinos or places that they used to play at. They're given free hotel rooms. They're given gifts. Depending on how much money you've spent, there's often specific rooms you can go into to choose gifts for these specific players. So it's very difficult to pull yourself out when there's so many cues and triggers around. And often people have a lot of debt in the end from gambling. And so there's this thought, like, I just need a big win. Gambling is the thing that will pull me out of all of these problems that I now have related to finances, for example. But that's a false the gambler's fallacy. That's a false hope, unfortunately. And I think the impacts of problem gambling, not just on the individual, but on the families and intergenerationally, are huge. There's so many harms that family members and friends related to those with gambling problems suffer. And this can go on, like I said, for multiple generations as people get into cycles of poverty. There's extreme mistrust of partners. There's one of the things I always try and highlight is gambling, problem gambling is associated with very, very high rates of suicide. And people often don't talk about that. And they don't mention or they don't draw the line back to gambling. They talk about somebody being depressed or somebody, maybe committing a crime or something. But it's the line is not fully drawn back to the fact that this stems from gambling.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Iris Bolotis, Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurosciences at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. She's also Associate Director of the University's Peter Boris Center for Addictions Research. Maybe this is just a variation on the last question, but if we were to talk about stigma and problem gambling, are there any nuances that you think it's important to understand, or are there any ways that people could reduce unnecessary stigma to allow people to get help or like nip a problem in the bud before it gets out of hand?
I think that's a really good question, and I do think the stigma around gambling is different. I think that With substance use disorders, there's been more of a shift over the past few decades, where people understand that this is a disease, that, for example, alcohol use disorder is a disease, it's a brain disease, and people can understand the idea of a substance having extreme power over you. I think the stigma around gambling is still quite far back. There's still a very moralistic model where it's still up to the individual. Why can't you control yourself? Why did you make these choices? There's this blame on the individual, when in fact gambling is one of the first behavioral addictions to be recognized, but it's still not seen that way. I think by many individuals, there's still this view of, someone who's not able to control themselves, and there's this lack of focus on all of the things that may have led someone to gambling, as I mentioned, the environment, gaming features, etc.
From a research standpoint, what do we know about the pathway out of experiencing problem gambling?
That's a good question. I think it's difficult. I think it's slow. I think what people need to know is that there is help available. I think reaching out to counselors, there are good established therapies that have been validated for gambling disorder. So things like cognitive behavioral therapy or motivational interviewing or some sort of combination of the two. Like with substance use disorders, there's a lot of similarities in terms of treatments that are available and that do work. It does take time and it's very difficult, but there is help out there.
Earlier on in our conversation, you identified that the government of Ontario is taking in a lot of revenue from gambling, and therefore you feel it isn't in a place to be the one giving oversight to this issue, because it's not going to have incentive to find problems that might reduce that revenue. What for you is the best pathway out of that?
I think that's a very good question. I think what we need is independent arm's length research and strategies to monitor what is going on in Ontario and have, or I guess even more broadly, in Canada, have a better idea of how our world is now affected by gambling. We need to have a provincial first, I guess, in Ontario, and then a national initiative across different institutions, for example, universities or research societies, to try and implement and validate best practices. What do we need in Canada as the gambling field continues to change? And we need to have universally accepted best practices that are based on very good science. So the work has to be done, the research has to be done. And I think we need a framework again that's independent, that's arm's length, in order to really understand what's going on and help those that have problems with gambling or prevent people from developing problem gambling.
A few times in our conversation as well, some comparisons have come up between gambling and various different forms of substance use. Are there any nuances you think people need to know when either making those comparisons about things that do overlap and things that are distinct?
That's a good question. There is a lot of overlap with gambling and substance use disorders, and we know that from a phenomenological point of view, how it occurs. We know that from treatment perspective that similar treatments tend to help. From a neurobiological perspective too, there's one of the reasons that gambling disorder was reclassified in a new addictions category is based on some of the neurobiological findings, that there's quite a bit of similarity that we see between substance-based and non-substance-based disorders. So there is a lot of overlap. I think with gambling, some of the differences are some of the features related to the games, in particular. One unique criteria is chasing losses. So this is often going back in another session or later in the day to win back what you lost, because people often think, well, what are the chances of me losing 500 times in a row. So that idea, and a lot of that taps back into gaming features, which are slightly unique, of course, to gambling disorder. And they, as I mentioned, they tap into ways that we make decisions with, playing with reinforcement schedules, things like that. The other, I think, area of overlap that I should probably highlight that many people probably have already noticed with their kids is that gaming is very similar to gambling. And in fact, people are noticing more and more that gambling features are starting to work their way into gaming, and vice versa. Gaming features are starting to work their way into gambling. So the gamification of lots of gambling-like activities. With youth, there's now loot boxes, skins, ways that you can insert risk and unknowns for money into games that really didn't inherently have those features, but they're now part of games. And again, we need to understand what this does to an individual over time, particularly in those that are very young and are just being exposed to all these features for the first time.
So there are loot boxes in video games. I think as well, since this change, when this change in Ontario came in around sports gambling specifically, if you were watching any kind of sport, you saw the broadcast changed, the advertising changed. There was a wave of advertising. We've since seen some changes to the laws around, say, for example, when exactly celebrities can appear in a gambling ad. That has changed a bit. Do you feel like we're going in the right direction on how this issue is portrayed in, I'll just say, in the media?
I think there's still a lot that needs to change. I think when I see things in the media, the portrayal of gambling is still very one-sided. There's, and you mentioned just briefly now, celebrities that endorse. And I know that there has been some legislation around not allowing celebrities, but there's still this culture. If you look at how gambling's presented, it's fun, everyone's together, everyone's laughing, you're social, you're popular, there's lots of this going on. And that can be in sometimes, but the reality for many people is you're by yourself, you're at home, there's no party going on, you may have just lost a lot of money. So I think the way it's portrayed is not very accurate to how most people experience gambling now, because it is changing. So I think we still have a long way to go. And as I said, that stigma is very, very potent for gambling, in particular for problem gambling. There's always this FOMO that's presented. Your friends are all gambling. Why aren't you? You want to be with that. That's still very prominent that I can see out there in the media. And that idea of being a VIP, that you're better, that you have better strategies, that you can outwit the system or you can outwit the game is misrepresented widely.
Earlier on, you talked about how gambling is something that a majority of people do in some way, shape, or form. What are the things we need to put if we're building a bridge to get across to a place where, the majority of people do this and the majority of people do it in a healthy way and problems have been minimized as much as can be? Like, what do we still need to do?
I think it's something that will always, just like other aspects of public health, it always needs to be monitored and understood, because gambling is something that's constantly changing. So even in my lifetime, traditionally people played more at casinos, it was somewhere to go, to nowadays sports gambling is ubiquitous with any sporting event at this point. It's very rare that people watch a sport and they don't have skin invested in the game, so to speak. It's completely changed. So it's changed the culture around sporting, because people are literally invested in it. We also have our phones or our smartphones, which are able to, deliver all sorts of games and all sorts of gaming features that we barely understand how they work. I always say that researchers are often years behind the industry in understanding what these gaming features are. I don't think most people in the industry care what the neurobiological underpinnings are of something. They just notice, hey, people play 2 hours longer if we do these features and we repeat them over and over. We make X amount of money more. That they notice those things. Why that might occur is of less interest to them. But from us as researchers to understand how these very simple strategies can change the decisions that you make is extremely interesting. And I think it taps even more broadly into how humans make decisions.
Iris Belotis, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for your interest again in the topic.
Iris Belotis is Associate Director of the Peter Boris Center for Addictions Research at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.